Hello, and welcome to Thinking Aloud. My name is Mike Earle. This is show number 2. Near the end of the last program, I shared with you my vision of a coming golden age, a veritable utopia of world peace, material abundance, unprecedented creativity. In short, an earthly paradise in which people everywhere live happy, purposeful lives. Now, I know this probably strikes most of you as wishful thinking on steroids, but I've got to be honest with you here. I really believe this. In fact, I think it's inevitable. It's my belief that a world of peace, creativity, and happiness is simply the natural state of intelligent beings. But intelligent beings who have figured their world out. And that's the catch. Or perhaps the challenge. You see, before this golden age can become a reality, we must first bring our beliefs about the world into harmony with the way the world really is. In other words, we've got to get our worldview right. Now, getting our worldview right involves a couple of things. Obviously, it means formulating that correct worldview itself. And we're working on that. But it also means letting go of the many mistaken worldviews we've collected along the way. This will be no simple task. Many of these worldviews have been around for thousands of years and are embraced by untold millions of people worldwide. Be that as it may, I think we will, ultimately, get beyond these mistakes. Again, I think it's inevitable. I guess you might call me an optimist. Then again, you might just call me crazy. And I can understand that response, especially in light of the problems that plague today's world. Watching the evening news, it can sometimes feel like our world is literally coming apart at the seams. I'm not blind to these realities. In fact, I'm probably more acutely aware of them than most people. And that's because I think I understand more than most people the ideological issues that lie at the heart of many of today's problems. Issues that most people, even many well-credentialed experts, simply refuse to take seriously. Consider, for example, the ideological conflict that exists among the world's 3 monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. These religions, all of them, promote ideas that make it all but impossible for the adherents of these faiths to coexist on the same planet without killing each other. Let me give you just a small taste of what I'm talking about, and let's start with Judaism. Judaism teaches that there is one God. Judaism also teaches that once upon a time this one God spoke to a man named Moses. Sometimes this God would tell Moses to kill people. For example, in Deuteronomy 18, God tells Moses to kill false prophets. In verse 20, God says, quote, "A prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded him to say must be put to death." Unquote. This is just one of many passages that can help us to understand why these monotheistic religions have so much trouble getting along. To illustrate what I mean, consider how this kill the false prophets law would apply to Jesus and Muhammad, the founders of the other 2 monotheistic religions, Christianity and Islam. Let's look first at Jesus. According to the New Testament, and according to Christians the world over, Jesus not only spoke in the name of God, Jesus was God. Do Jews recognize Jesus as God? Of course not. The very idea is blasphemy. Do Jews recognize Jesus even as a true prophet of God? Of course not. If they did, they'd all be Christians. The very fact that Jews are not Christians is evidence that Jews reject the assertion that Jesus was a true prophet. Therefore, according to Jewish ideology, Jesus was a false prophet. What does the Jewish version of the one true God say must be done to false prophets? He says they must be put to death. In other words, the Jewish version of the one true God has declared that the Christian version of the one true God must be destroyed. Hardly a recipe for peace on earth. How about Muhammad? Muhammad claimed to be a prophet of the one true God, even the greatest of the prophets. Do Jews recognize Muhammad as a prophet of the one true God, even the greatest of the prophets? Of course not. If they did, they'd all be Muslims. The very fact that Jews are not Muslims is evidence that Jews reject the assertion that Muhammad was a true prophet. Therefore, according to Jewish ideology, Muhammad was a false prophet. What does the Jewish version of the one true God say must be done to false prophets? He says they must be put to death. In other words, the Jewish version of the one true God believes that Muhammad, the founder of Islam, must be put to death. According to the Jewish version of monotheism, Jesus and Muhammad are false prophets. They are imposters. They are fakes. And as such, they are guilty of capital crimes worthy of death. Now, I know it's not considered polite to state these things in such dark terms, but folks, this is our situation, and we ignore it at our peril. Let's turn now to Christianity. Christianity teaches that there is one God. Moreover, Jesus taught, and Paul taught, and Peter taught, and Christian authorities for nearly 2,000 years have taught that anyone who does not worship Jesus as the one true God will be condemned to hell. Now, do Jews worship Jesus as the one true God? No. Do Muslims worship Jesus as the one true God? Of course not. Therefore, according to the one true God of Christianity, all Jews and all Muslims are going to hell. Let's turn now to Islam. Islam teaches that there is one God. According to the one true God of Islam, if you don't accept Muhammad as the greatest of God's prophets, then you're going to burn in hell. In other words, if you don't believe that Muhammad is a prophet greater than Moses and greater than Jesus, you're going to burn in hell. Now, do Jews believe Muhammad is greater than Moses? No. Do Christians believe Muhammad is greater than Jesus? Of course not. Therefore, according to the one true God of Islam, all Jews and all Christians are going to burn in hell. And let me add that the Quran contains many exquisitely graphic descriptions of hell. For example, in Surah 22 we read, quote, "For those who have disbelieved, garments of fire shall be cut out. The boiling water shall be poured down upon their heads. All that is in their bowels and their skins shall be dissolved." Unquote. Well, that sounds fairly painful. I bet it doesn't smell very good either. Even so, according to the one true God of Islam, this cosmic torture chamber is the future home of all Christians and all Jews, not to mention just about everybody else in the world. What we have here is a collision of three incompatible ideologies, all claiming to represent the one true God, and a violent God at that. Is it any wonder that these people have been murdering each other for more than 1,000 years? Like it or not, ideas have consequences. Bad ideas have bad consequences. When I argue that we must get beyond the mistakes of the past before this golden age I envision can become a reality, these monotheistic ideologies are exactly the kinds of mistakes I'm talking about. Of course, bogus worldviews are not limited to religion. The events of the 20th century made that pretty clear. But the religious ones appear to be our biggest challenge at the present. Mistaken worldviews, whatever their source, have got to go. But that means we've got to change. We've got to be like those people in that dark room allegory I talked about last time. Those people were willing to change. They adapted their beliefs to the presence of new light. And that willingness to adapt ultimately led to their success. But a willingness to adapt means a willingness to change. And that's what we have to do. We have to be willing to change. Now, to be sure, worldviews have changed over the centuries. For example, we no longer believe the sun orbits the earth. We no longer believe witches are responsible for crop failures. We no longer believe mental illness to be a product of demon possession. Actually, I should probably say that most people no longer believe these things. But clearly there has been change. Radical change. Positive change. This isn't just me seeing the glass as half full. This is a clear trend that anyone willing to look at the historical data can see for himself. Now, some people might argue that although change does happen, It happens only because those who cling to old ways of thinking die out. And there's clearly something to that. After all, that's basically how evolution works. But that's an awfully slow process. Frankly, I'd like to speed things up, if we can. Of course, that presents us with a much greater challenge. For now we have to effect a change not from one generation to the next generation, but within the same generation. And this means changing the minds of individuals. What's the best way to do that? Is it even possible? It's often said that people don't change. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. Well, I don't necessarily buy that. I think people can change. I know they can change because I've changed and I've seen others change. Change happens. The question is, what causes this kind of change in an individual? What moves a person to let go of an old belief system and embrace a new one? We know it happens. How does it happen? Is there a formula for this kind of change? And if there is a formula, how might we use it in an effort to hasten the coming of this golden age I keep talking about? I don't pretend to have the answers to all these questions, but I do have some ideas on the subject, and I want to share some of those ideas with you today. And what I'll be sharing with you is based largely on some ideas most famously articulated in a book written by a guy named Thomas Kuhn. Some of you are probably familiar with the book. The book's title is The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. In his book, Thomas Kuhn examines what he famously calls paradigms. What is a paradigm? The answer to that question has been a matter of some debate, and even Kuhn himself has been accused of failing to articulate a precise definition. But whatever else a paradigm might be, an important feature common to all paradigms is a belief about what something is or how that something works. For example, evolution by natural selection is a paradigm. Intelligent design is a paradigm. The Big Bang theory is a paradigm. Communism is a paradigm. Islam is a paradigm. All of these things are paradigms. Now, sometimes a paradigm turns out to be wrong. By wrong, I mean that the paradigm fails to accurately portray those features of reality it purports to represent. Awareness of these inconsistencies can, potentially, lead to a revision of the paradigm. In some radical cases, the existing paradigm might be abandoned altogether and replaced with a whole new paradigm. Thomas Kuhn famously refers to these conceptual upheavals as paradigm shifts. The history of science has witnessed many paradigm shifts, some of which have been truly revolutionary. Probably the most famous of these was the so-called Copernican Revolution. The Copernican Revolution entailed the abandonment of an Earth-centered paradigm of the universe and its replacement with a Sun-centered paradigm. Another equally dramatic paradigm shift, and one that continues to unfold even to this day, is what we might call the Darwinian Revolution, or as I sometimes like to call it, the Evolution Revolution. In his book, Thomas Kuhn restricts his focus to paradigm shifts as they occur within scientific communities. But paradigm shifts can occur in areas other than science, and they can happen to individuals as well as communities. For example, if you were to discover late in life that you were adopted, that would be a paradigm shift. Learning that your spouse has been cheating on you for the past 6 months, that would be a paradigm shift. For many of us, the attacks of 9/11 were a paradigm shift. Internet dating can be a paradigm shift. Especially that moment you finally meet that person and they don't look anything like that picture they sent. That's a paradigm shift. Now, it's my belief that many of the lessons Thomas Kuhn learned through his study of scientific communities can be applied, really, to any paradigm shift. So acquainting ourselves with these lessons may help us in our quest for a golden age, since any road leading to that golden age will be paved with paradigm shifts. Understanding the dynamics of these shifts may help us to move down that road more quickly, which in my opinion would be a very good thing. So what did Thomas Kuhn learn? Well, in a nutshell, he learned that a paradigm shift is a mental event that is really a byproduct of two other mental events. One of these mental events is an awareness of what Kuhn calls anomalies in the existing paradigm. The other mental event is an awareness of a new paradigm, an alternative paradigm. And this new paradigm must be such that what was an anomaly in the old paradigm is something that is just expected in the new paradigm. Now, that was a bit of a mouthful, so let me see if I can clarify these ideas with an example. Let's look first at this idea of anomaly. What is an anomaly? According to Thomas Kuhn, an anomaly is a violation of some expectation created by your paradigm. Remember, a paradigm entails a belief about some feature of the world. This belief will, necessarily, create expectations about the world. If our experience of the world clashes with these expectations, then we have experienced an anomaly. To illustrate what I mean by this, let's imagine that we're assembling a jigsaw puzzle. The picture on the front of the box that our puzzle came in, that would be our paradigm. Let's say that the picture on the front of our puzzle box is a black and white photograph of Humphrey Bogart. This black and white photograph is our paradigm, and as such, it creates expectations about the kinds of puzzle pieces we will encounter while working this puzzle. In our case, specifically, we expect all the pieces to be black and white pieces. Now, if while working our puzzle, we were to encounter, say, a red piece, then that red piece would be an anomaly. According to our paradigm, we shouldn't encounter any red pieces. So finding this red piece violates our expectation. Now, we want to make sure the piece really is red. We want to make sure the red isn't spaghetti sauce or lipstick or blood. We want to make sure the piece really is red. But if it is red, then we've encountered a bona fide anomaly. And anomalies are extremely important because they are the first indicators that something might be wrong with our current paradigm and that a change might be in order. But awareness of anomalies alone is not enough to affect a paradigm shift, according to Thomas Kuhn. There must also be a new paradigm, an alternative paradigm, to replace the old. And this alternative paradigm must be such that what was an anomaly in the old paradigm becomes the expected in the new paradigm. Returning to our puzzle example, let's say that we're working this puzzle and we're coming across a whole bunch of red pieces. And this is really starting to bother us. In fact, it bothers us so much that we begin to entertain the radical notion that maybe the puzzle we're working on here isn't a black and white photograph of Humphrey Bogart after all. Maybe it's something else. Something with red in it. Desperate for an answer to our dilemma, we decide to contact the company that made the puzzle. So we give them a call, and lo and behold, we are told that there was a mistake made at the puzzle factory. It seems that there was a batch of puzzles that got put into the wrong boxes. Specifically, a batch of Humphrey Bogart boxes were mistakenly filled with puzzles of red fire trucks. Upon hearing this news, the scales begin to fall from our eyes. We've got a new paradigm. A fire truck. A red fire truck. And armed with this new paradigm, we now expect to find red pieces. And that's exactly what Thomas Kuhn said our new paradigm needs to do. What was an anomaly in our old paradigm becomes the expected in our new paradigm. And that, in a nutshell, is Kuhn's formula. A formula for paradigm shift. And arguably, a formula for changing someone's mind. What does the formula say? Well, the formula seems to suggest two things. First, that we call attention to anomalies in a person's current paradigm. And second, that we offer that person an alternative paradigm in which the anomalies go away. And if we do that, the person will have a paradigm shift. It seems like a simple enough formula, but is it really all that simple? And more important, does it work? Let me share with you a personal experience. As some of you might know, I used to be a Mormon. I was not always an active Mormon, but there came a point in my life, at about the age of 19, when I became very active in the church and would remain active for several years. During this period, I served a full-time 2-year mission for the church to Montana and Wyoming. I graduated from Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah, I taught Sunday school. I was a ward mission leader. I held other church positions. So for several years at least, I was very active in the church. Well, to make a long story very short, I would eventually part ways with the Mormon Church and would ultimately abandon religion altogether. As I mentioned in the last program, today I'm an atheist. It was a radical transition, to be sure, and like others who have made similar transitions, I felt a desire, even a responsibility, to tell other people what I had learned through this experience. And a lot of what I wanted to tell people involved looking back at my old religion and pointing out what I thought was wrong with it. I became especially focused on moral issues, specifically morality and its functional relationship to religion, especially its relationship to holy books like the Bible. I began organizing my thoughts on the subject and even started writing them down. This writing would eventually evolve into a book I called Bible Stories Your Parents Never Taught You. Actually, the project began as a spoken word presentation, a sort of monologue, kind of like what I'm doing here. And then the book was later adapted from those presentations. Well, what does my writing a book about morality have to do with paradigm shifts? Well, quite simply, my goal in Bible Stories Your Parents Never Taught You was to bring to people's awareness the existence of moral anomalies in the Bible. Let me explain. There's a paradigm that has gripped American culture from colonial times to the present. This paradigm says that the Holy Bible is the greatest book of moral wisdom ever written. According to this paradigm, the Holy Bible is not merely a good book, it is the good book. It's the good book. That's the paradigm. And like any paradigm, this one creates certain expectations. Specifically, it creates expectations about the kinds of teachings and stories we should encounter when reading the Bible. Like, they should all be good. Well, during the course of my transition out of religion, I became acutely aware of Bible stories that, to my feeble mind at least, were not good at all. In fact, I found many of these stories downright atrocious. For example, there's a story in Numbers chapter 31 about a guy who was stoned to death for merely breaking the Sabbath. He was caught, quote-unquote, caught gathering wood on the Sabbath day. And the Israelites, God's chosen people, they take this guy into custody and they kill him. And they don't kill him because they just feel like killing him. They kill him because God explicitly tells them to. So this wasn't a bunch of Jewish extremists who had hijacked the religion. This was God's standing law. Now, today I look at a story like this and I think, this isn't good. I mean, they just killed some guy for doing yard work. This isn't moral. This is murder. This is an anomaly. Now, I didn't call it an anomaly at the time. I hadn't read Kuhn's book yet. I didn't know the lingo. But that's exactly what it was. The story is a violation of what I would expect to find in the world's most moral book. In my book, Bible Stories Your Parents Never Taught You, I focus a critical light on dozens of these moral anomalies. Acts of genocide, slavery and the slave trade, death penalties for blasphemy, adultery, homosexuality, working on the Sabbath, to name just a few things. My thinking was this. Surely once people became aware of these horrific teachings, they will see the error of this biblical paradigm and they will reject it, just as I did. After all, there's no way anyone could possibly believe this stuff, right? Well, that was the thinking behind my book. Bring these moral anomalies to people's attention, and a paradigm shift would surely follow. I thought this approach made perfect sense. So much so, that deep down I was half expecting the publication of my book to trigger a mass exodus out of religion. Well, needless to say, things didn't quite happen like that. Although atheists generally seemed to like the book, I found the response from religious people, well, troubling. What troubled me was not so much that they disagreed with the work. Rather, what troubled me was that these barbaric stories I was exposing them to seemed to have absolutely no effect on them at all. I found this baffling. I mean, where's the moral outrage? Now, I know for a fact that acts of barbarism do indeed rile these people. After all, when the Taliban in Afghanistan stoned someone to death for adultery, these people come unglued. It's a cause for war. So in the case of the Taliban, the immorality is obvious. And yet when confronted with the very same acts of barbarism in their Bible, they don't even flinch. This is really astonishing. I mean, you show these people, right from the pages of their own Bible, the verses that condone the slavery, the stonings, even the genocides, and they are unfazed. It's as if they are unable to see something that's right in front of their face. What's going on here? Interestingly enough, Thomas Kuhn had something to say about this very phenomenon. In his book, Thomas Kuhn refers to a famous study conducted in 1949 by two Harvard psychologists, Jerome Bruner and Leo Postman. In their study, Bruner and Postman would expose subjects to a series of playing cards. The cards were flashed on a screen in short exposures, and the subjects were asked to identify the cards. Unbeknownst to the subjects, however, some of the cards, not all of the cards, but some of the cards, were made bogus. For example, one of the cards was a red six of spades. Think about it. A six of spades should be black, not red. As each subject was exposed to these bogus cards, what do you suppose happened? Did the person immediately respond, "Hey, that's a bogus card. It's red, but it should be black. You guys are playing a trick on me." Did they do that? No, they didn't do that. Initially, the subjects would, without hesitation, identify the bogus card as perfectly normal. For example, if exposed to the red six of spades, they would identify it as either a perfectly normal six of hearts or a perfectly normal six of spades. In other words, the bogus features of the card went unnoticed. However, with repeated and lengthened exposures, the subjects would begin to sense that something was amiss. And at some point, nearly all of the subjects would experience a breakthrough. At some point, the subject would finally see the bogus features of the card. At this point, and not before this point, did the person experience what Thomas Kuhn would call an anomaly. And it's at this point, and not before this point, that the person's paradigm would begin to shift. I find this absolutely remarkable. I mean, think about this. Prior to this perceptual breakthrough, as far as the subject was concerned, the bogus card simply did not exist, even though it was right there in front of his face. Here's something else that's remarkable. Once a person had experienced this breakthrough, from that point forward, he had little problem identifying the other bogus cards. So before the breakthrough, the bogus cards were imperceptible. After the breakthrough, they were obvious. Let me share with you another personal experience. As I mentioned earlier, I used to be a Mormon. It's on my dad's side of the family that I get my link with the Mormon Church. Our family's Mormon roots go all the way back to the pre-Utah days, when the Mormons were living in Nauvoo, Illinois, and when Mormon founder Joseph Smith was still alive. So our family goes way back. My dad was not always an active Mormon, but he was always a Mormon and would never dream of being anything but a Mormon. Not surprisingly, when I left the church, Dad was not exactly thrilled. Don't get me wrong, he didn't disown me or anything like that. He just thought I'd made a big mistake, and he didn't hesitate to tell me so. Anyway, Dad and I began having regular and quite serious discussions about God, religion, the meaning of life, things like that. And during our discussions, I would routinely tell Dad about these Bible atrocities. And I would say to him, "Look, this is a big reason why I left religion." But like other religious people I had confronted with these stories, they had almost no impact on my father. Anyway, during the course of our discussions, Dad would often encourage me to get back into religion. But Dad had a little problem. You see, at the time, Dad wasn't exactly living the religion himself. For example, Dad liked to have a beer every now and then, or perhaps a glass of wine. Mormons aren't supposed to do that. So for Dad to tell me to get with the program was a bit hypocritical. To remedy this, Dad decided that he needed to get his spiritual house in order. To help motivate himself to follow through, he set himself the goal of going through one of the Mormon temples. Let me say just a couple of things about Mormon temples. A Mormon temple is not an ordinary church meeting house. Mormons do not attend church meetings in a temple in the same way Catholics might attend Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City. A Mormon temple is a place where only very special ceremonies are performed. Ceremonies like baptisms for the dead, eternal marriages, which are also called sealings, and something called the endowment, which was a ceremony my dad would be participating in. Temples are not open to the general public. In fact, they aren't even open to all Mormons. If you want to go inside a temple, you must first obtain what is called a temple recommend. A temple recommend is a little card issued by the church that certifies that you are worthy to enter the temple. Your worthiness is determined via an interview with a local church leader. During this interview, you are asked several questions, some of which are quite personal. Among other things, they ask if you support the church leaders. They ask if you live what Mormons call the word of wisdom, which is this rule that says that Mormons should abstain from alcohol, coffee, tea, and smoking. They ask if you engage in any unauthorized sexual conduct. And of course, they ask if you are a full tithe payer. These were just some of the hoops Dad would have to jump through if he wanted to see the inside of a temple. And I've got to hand it to the guy. He did it. He got his act together, passed his interview, and he got his temple recommend. With this worthiness hurdle now behind him, Dad was anxious to go through the temple as soon as possible. Now, I want to emphasize something here. My dad had really big expectations about his upcoming temple experience. One of the things he was hoping to gain from the experience was a stronger testimony. Now, I need to say something real quick about Mormons and testimonies, because Mormons are really big on this idea of testimony. If you spend any time at all talking with an active Mormon about his religion, he will probably, at some point, bear you his testimony. What exactly is a testimony? Well, to a Mormon, a testimony is a statement in which he asserts to know certain things to be true. Things like the existence of God, the bodily resurrection of Jesus, the divine calling of Joseph Smith, the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon, things like that. When a Mormon bears you his testimony, he doesn't merely tell you that he believes these things to be true. Rather, he knows they are true. Knows it absolutely. Knows it with every fiber of his being. Dad wanted a stronger testimony, and he was convinced that his upcoming temple experience would be the event that would take his testimony to the next level. So he had big expectations. He was half expecting a vision or some other miracle. In the Mormon church, rumors abound of miracles taking place in these temples. Visions, personal visitations from Jesus himself, things like that. These rumors only stoked the fires of Dad's already grandiose expectations. Well, the big day finally arrived, and Dad got to go through the temple. To say the experience was not what Dad was expecting would be a profound understatement. He found the whole experience weird and disturbing. Very disturbing. Now, this doesn't surprise me because I've been through the temple on several occasions, and I know from first-hand experience that some of the stuff they do in those buildings is just plain weird. Now, they don't perform human sacrifices or have wild orgies or anything like that. Let's not get carried away here. But they do weird things. For example, during the endowment ceremony, they make you wear these goofy-looking robes, a weird little hat, and a big green apron that looks like a fig leaf. You're also given what Mormons refer to as a temple garment, or as outsiders like to call it, holy underwear, which is exactly what it is. The ceremony also includes chantings and secret handshakes and secret names. And they make you take these really creepy oaths in which you pledge a willingness to give all your property and even your very life to the church if called upon to do so. Even creepier still, they make you take a blood oath in which you agree that you'd rather have your throat slit than reveal the secrets you learned inside the temple. Dad found all of this exceedingly disturbing, and understandably so. And the trouble didn't stop at the doors of the temple. Later that very same day, Dad began to lose sensation in his left arm. It became numb and very weak. Of course, we're thinking that Dad might be having a heart attack. So Dad checks into the hospital, and after a couple of days of tests, fortunately, it was determined that Dad was not having a heart attack. And after several days, the numbness eventually went away. At least that was good news. Nevertheless, the numbness in Dad's arm, occurring in such close proximity and time with this very negative temple experience, really had a profound impact on the guy. What did Dad make of it all? A couple of things happened. Within days of his temple experience, Dad began to view this bizarre string of events as a message from God. Now recall that prior to going through the temple, Dad had been praying for God to do something that would give him a stronger testimony of the church. Dad came to believe that God had indeed answered his prayers. It just wasn't the answer he was expecting. Rather than God telling him the church was true, God was telling him the church was not true. This was quite a shock for a man in his 70s who had spent his whole life in the Mormon church and, to the best of my knowledge, never once questioned its authority. But something else happened. Recall that prior to Dad's temple experience, I had been confronting him with these violent Bible stories, and they seemed to have no effect on the guy. But then something very interesting happens. Shortly after his temple experience, and I mean like days, Dad suddenly becomes aware of these things. And I mean really aware. The stonings, the genocides, the slavery. Now Dad's seeing all of this stuff, and he's just shocked by it all. He is appalled that anyone would attribute such barbaric acts to God, a being whom my dad had always thought of as a benevolent heavenly father. All of this really bothered my dad, so much so that he felt he had to do something about it. In fact, he came to believe that God, in some sense, had called him to perform some great and important work. And curiously enough, this great and important work was to involve yours truly. How so? Well, Dad believed that God wanted him to write a book. The title of this book was going to be In Defense of God. In this book, Dad was going to set the world straight about the Mormon Church and about how God was being slandered in books like the Holy Bible. My role in this glorious work was to help Dad write this book. Specifically, he wanted me to write some chapters on Bible atrocities. It seems that I was the resident expert. Of course, I had to remind my dad, repeatedly, that I was an atheist, and as such could hardly get behind a project titled In Defense of God. I did, however, agree to let Dad quote liberally from my own writings, which he did. Amazingly enough, Dad actually wrote this book. And he had big plans for the thing. He imagined himself on talk shows like Larry King, enlightening the masses with his message of truth, while exposing the falsehoods of Mormonism and the atrocities of the Bible. He even talked about starting a new church. God's Church of Truth, he was going to call it. Yep, Dad had big plans indeed. Now, I'm guessing that this is the first time you've heard of the book, In Defense of God, by Gerald Erickson Earle, a fact that would seem to suggest that things didn't turn out quite the way my dad was hoping. So why am I telling you about my dad? Well, a couple of reasons. For starters, Dad's story is a dramatic example of someone who had changed his mind in a very big way. Here was a guy in his 70s who within a matter of weeks went from being a devout Mormon with a temple recommend to an aspiring author of anti-Mormon literature who wanted to start his own church. That's a fairly radical change of mind. But more to the point of our larger discussion, Dad's experience is an example of what Thomas Kuhn would call a paradigm shift, and it's one that dramatically illustrates some of the important points Kuhn was arguing in his book, especially as it concerns the experience of anomaly. Remember, an anomaly is a violation of some expectation created by a paradigm. Dad's temple experience was an anomaly. He walked into that temple with an expectation that it was going to be all wonderful and uplifting, and it wasn't like that. Instead, it was weird and cultish. So his expectation was violated. That's a textbook anomaly. But there's something else about this anomaly business that needs to be said. And this should be of interest to anyone interested in changing the minds of religious people. Think back one more time to that study with those bogus playing cards. Recall that initially, the subjects were effectively blind to the bogus cards. But then a breakthrough occurred, and from that point forward, they could spot them easily. Now, map this onto my dad's experience. Think about this. For at least 2 years prior to his temple experience, I had been exposing Dad to these Bible atrocities, and they didn't seem to faze him at all. But then something happens to him inside that temple, and almost overnight, he begins to see these things. And he sees them all. It was as if someone had turned on a light in a dark room. I think there's a very important lesson here. As freethinkers, we tend to view this project of changing the religious person's mind primarily as one of getting that person to stop believing in something. And so what we do is we point out to that person what we believe are problems in his belief system. We point to atrocities in the Bible. We point to contradictions in the Bible. We talk about the problem of evil. We talk about God's failure to answer prayers. We talk about the logical problems with the very concept of God itself. In short, we focus on the problems, and in doing this, we are attempting to induce what Thomas Kuhn would call an experience of anomaly. But as ought to be clear by now, getting a person to see the anomalies in his paradigm, and especially a religious paradigm, is not as easy as simply waving a bunch of Bible verses in front of his face. And yet, this is exactly what we do. We point out these moral and logical problems. We try to formulate ever more brilliant arguments. And when these arguments fail to move the person, which is pretty much always, we stand there wondering what went wrong. Well, what did go wrong? Here's what I think. I think we have made a fundamental mistake. I think we have misdiagnosed the challenge before us. We're like a doctor treating someone for a broken leg when it's a person's arm that's really broken. What do I mean by that? What I mean is this. In our efforts to induce this experience of anomaly, we seem to operate under the assumption that this is an intellectual challenge. I think that's a mistake. The challenge we face is not an intellectual challenge. The challenge we face is a perceptual challenge. It's been said that a problem accurately defined is half solved. I think we have failed to accurately define our problem. We've always assumed it to be an intellectual problem. But it's not an intellectual problem. It's a perceptual problem. When you stop and think about it, the intellectual nature of what we're dealing with here is extraordinarily simple. This is not rocket science. Stoning a Sabbath breaker to death? Come on, that's easy. It's wrong. It's murder. It's murder. And yet when you confront many religious people with this, what do they say? Oh, let me go talk to my minister about this. Why do you need to talk to your minister about this? You can't figure this one out on your own? Can't you see this anomaly? Apparently, they can't see it. When I was a Mormon, I was often told by other religious people that my beliefs were nutty. All this talk about gold plates, angels, Jesus coming to America. They thought I was crazy to believe such things. And yet these very same people insist that Moses parted the Red Sea, that Jonah lived inside the belly of a fish for 3 days, that Jesus walked on water, that Jesus flew through the air, that Jesus rose from the dead. Talk about the pot calling the kettle black. They had no trouble seeing the anomalies in my beliefs. Couldn't they see the anomalies in their own beliefs? Apparently, they couldn't see them. And that's my whole point. The challenge we face is not intellectual. The challenge we face is perceptual. And I don't know about you, But it's been my experience that once this perceptual barrier is breached, the intellectual part pretty much takes care of itself. That was certainly the case with my dad. Now let me be clear about something. Ultimately, what we're talking about here is intellectual. After all, we're talking about ideas. But before an intellectual evaluation of ideas can even begin, we must first breach those perceptual barriers. Why is it that religion, more than other areas, presents us with such an enormous challenge when it comes to the perception of anomalies? Let me share with you just one possibility, one hypothesis, if you will. It has to do with expectations. The unique perceptual challenge that religion presents may be a consequence of the unique expectations religion instills in a believer. In their study with those bogus playing cards, Bruner and Postman make an interesting observation. They write the following, and I quote, "Stimuli do not act upon an indifferent organism. The organism in perception is, in one way or another, in a state of expectancy about the environment. It is a truism worth repeating that the perceptual effect of a stimulus is necessarily dependent upon the expectancy of the organism." End of quote. In other words, the experience of perception is a function of two things, a stimulus and an expectation. If one of these components is missing, there will be no perception. The stimulus component is something that is outside of the person. It's that bogus playing card or violent passage of scripture. The expectation component, on the other hand, is something that is inside the person. It's his religious belief system, his paradigm. It's this expectation component that religion acts upon. And it's the unique nature of this religious expectation that makes the perception of anomalies such a difficult and curious challenge. To illustrate what I mean by this, consider for a moment that in every area of our lives, with the exception of religion, we have an expectation of imperfection. We just expect human beings to screw up from time to time. Even if we're talking about someone or something we deeply care about, a member of our family, one of our heroes, some pet project we've been working on, as much as we may cherish these things, and as much as they may please us most of the time, we nevertheless hold out the possibility that imperfections can occur. Not so with religion. The true believer insists that his God is perfect in every way. That's his belief. That's his expectation. And it's an expectation that has deep psychological roots. More often than not, this expectation is drilled into that person's head when he is a child, and is thereafter reinforced with all manner of emotional carrots and sticks. With this expectation firmly in place, the believer is rendered incapable of conceiving a whole range of possibilities. For example, because God is perfect, it is impossible for God to make a mistake. It is impossible for God to speak an untruth. It is impossible for God to do anything immoral. It is impossible for God to command anything immoral. No matter what God says or does, his actions cannot be viewed as mistaken or immoral. The believer's expectations simply will not allow it. As a consequence, the mistakes, the immoralities, the anomalies simply go unperceived. If Bruner and Postman are right, these things don't even register in the person's mind. Now the temptation here is for us to think, no, religious people really do see these things. They know the Bible teachings are wrong. They have to know. How could they not know? After all, they're looking right at the thing. Therefore, religious people are simply in a state of willful denial. They're being intellectually dishonest. Or they're just plain stupid. Now, it's tempting to think that. And a lot of atheists I know do think that. I used to think that. And indeed, that would be the situation if what we were dealing with here was purely intellectual. But this is my whole point. It's not purely intellectual. It's perceptual. I don't think religious people are stupid. I think religious people, most of them anyway, simply fail to perceive the errors and immoralities in their belief systems. And the cause of this failure is this expectation of perfection they bring to any discussion relating to the subject of God. This expectation erects a kind of perceptual wall, a wall that manifests itself as a kind of blind spot. And I can tell you from personal experience, these blind spots can hide a multitude of sin. Let me show you what I mean. I recall sitting in a Sunday school class many years ago, back in the days when I too had this God is perfect expectation. And on this particular day, we were learning about the story in the Old Testament book of 1 Samuel chapter 15. In this story, King Saul is told that he is going to lose his kingdom because he has failed to comply exactly with a direct order from God. The order pertained to an attack the Israelites had launched against a group of their enemies known as the Amalekites. The parts of this story that impressed me at the time illustrate the truly amazing power of this perceptual blind spot. Here's what impressed me about the story at the time. I remember that Saul had captured the Amalekite king and brought him back alive. I also remember that Saul brought back alive a bunch of animals. The captured king was a kind of trophy for the Israelite people, while the animals were going to be offered up to God as sacrifices. So Saul's intentions appeared to be righteous, at least righteous in the biblical sense. Unfortunately for Saul, God's explicit order required that he kill the king and the animals. Saul didn't do that, and as a consequence, Saul was going to lose his kingdom. And I remember the people in the classroom commenting, and I was thinking this too, that God was really being pretty harsh on old Saul. But then, this just underscores the need to obey God exactly. Obedience to God, even strict obedience, was the moral of this story. Anyway, these were the principal details of the story that impressed me at the time, oh, those many years ago. Well, that was then, this is now. Today, I bring to the very same story a very different set of expectations. It's the same story, same words, same stimuli, but different expectations. These new expectations make all the difference in the world. Now when I read this story, I see things that I didn't see before. Atrocious things. For example, I now see what God was ordering Saul to do. Specifically, God was ordering Saul to utterly exterminate these Amalekites. God's orders were explicit. Kill the men, kill the women, kill the children, kill the babies, kill the animals, and kill them all. Every last one of them. Bluntly put, God was ordering Saul to commit an act of genocide. And apparently, it was a rather large genocide because Saul assembled an army of more than 200,000 men to carry this order out. 200,000 men! That's an army larger than the ones we presently have stationed in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. So this was an incredible slaughter of men, women, children, babies, animals. And yet somehow, back in that Sunday school class, I totally missed this. And so did everyone else in the room. How could I have missed something like that? That would be like reading a history of the 20th century and failing to take notice of World War II. And it's not just me. Let me give you another quick example, and this is one we're all familiar with. The Genesis flood. Here we have a story in which God basically murders everyone on the planet, kills them by drowning, just like Andrea Yates did to her 5 children, only God murders everyone on the planet. Now, when Andrea Yates drowns her 5 children, she's condemned as a murderous lunatic. Yet when God drowns his millions of children, he's praised as the most just and merciful being in the universe. And people see no inconsistency here. It doesn't even register with them. I think Bruner and Postman hit the nail on the head when they wrote, "The perceptual effect of a stimulus is necessarily dependent upon the expectancy of the organism." Religion instills in people an expectation of God's perfection. And it's this expectation that makes it so difficult for religious people to perceive the anomalies in their paradigm. That's my hypothesis, at least. But it's one that I think agrees well with experience. Now, I know I've spent a lot of time on anomalies, but I think this is an important subject. And it's important because knowing the nature of what we're up against may help us to craft a more effective strategy of actually getting through to people. Let's face it, the strategy of hammering away at anomalies has a whole lot going against it. It's almost doomed from the start. And yet, this approach seems to be the one we use more than any other. So what am I suggesting? Am I suggesting that we abandon the anomaly approach altogether? No, not at all. Awareness of anomalies is a necessary component of any paradigm shift. That's what Thomas Kuhn taught, and I, for one, believe he was right. Moreover, I think calling attention to anomalies is very often the moral thing to do. I mean, somebody's got to be the whistleblower. Having said all that, I think we would be wise to recognize the unique challenges the anomaly approach presents and then act accordingly. Specifically, if there are other weapons in our intellectual arsenal, weapons that don't face the same perceptual and emotional barriers that the anomaly approach does, if such weapons do exist, then, by all means, we should haul them out. Do such weapons exist? I believe they do. What are they? Well, let's return to Thomas Kuhn one more time. Recall that Thomas Kuhn argued that a paradigm shift is a byproduct of two experiences. The first experience is the awareness of anomalies in the present paradigm. The second experience is the awareness of a new paradigm, an alternative paradigm, to take the place of the old. I've said quite a bit about anomalies. Let me say something now about alternatives. The sharing of an alternative paradigm is an approach to changing minds that I think holds enormous promise, and for several reasons. For one thing, when we focus on an alternative, we avoid many of the perceptual and emotional barriers we face when we focus on anomalies. Let's face it, pointing out the errors in someone's cherished beliefs is often perceived as a personal attack. You might as well tell them their kids are ugly. Predictably, they react negatively. The fight-or-flight instincts kick in. The defenses go up. This is hardly a receptive state of mind. By contrast, when we shift the focus to an alternative paradigm, the pressure is now off that other guy. It's our paradigm that's on the witness stand now. So he can relax. The defenses can come down. And in this state of mind, the person might actually be receptive to our ideas. I don't think we fully appreciate the opportunity this presents us with. Think about this. When we focus on an alternative, not only do we avoid triggering those negative emotions associated with anomalies, but we now have the opportunity to actively engage positive emotions. I think we need to milk this for all it's worth. Now, I'm not suggesting that we mislead people in any way. Not at all. I'm just saying that we shouldn't hesitate to convey a genuine enthusiasm for our own ideas. Look, when you share your ideas with another person, hopefully you're giving that other person something attractive to think about. After all, you want to entice that person to your way of seeing the world. You want that person to desire your ideas. You want that person to embrace your ideas. Listen to these words I'm using here. Entice, desire, embrace. This is a language of love. When we hammer away at anomalies, we're engaged in a kind of war. By contrast, when we offer someone an alternative, we're engaged in a kind of conceptual courtship. When it comes to changing minds, I think the presence of a clear alternative is more than just helpful. I think it's an indispensable part of the process. Think of it like this. Getting someone to make a paradigm shift is kind of like getting them to jump off a sinking boat. People are going to be very reluctant to jump off a boat, even a sinking boat, if there's no other boat for them to jump onto. Better to go down with the ship than leap into the cold, dark abyss. And besides, all their friends are on the sinking boat. In a situation like this, the most important thing we can do is offer them an alternative. We build them a boat. What would constitute an attractive alternative? As much as possible, I think it needs to satisfy those very things a person feels he's getting from his religion. Among other things, I think this would mean a coherent system of morality. It means a sense of meaning in life. It means a sense of purpose in life. It means a grand scheme of things view of reality, a kind of conceptual lens through which to understand the past, navigate the present, and confidently anticipate a hopeful and even glorious future. This is one reason I'm so upfront with this talk of a golden age, even at the risk of sounding a bit wacky. In addition to being something that I actually do believe in, this golden age represents an alternative to the worldviews promoted by many religions. So my motivation to promote this idea of a golden age is as much strategic as it is philosophical. You see, there is a method to my madness. Alternatives are crucial. Telling people you're an atheist is not enough. Telling them that you believe in science is not even enough. You've got to do more than that. People need more than that. Paint them a picture. Share with them your vision. Introduce them to a paradigm that is superior to the one that they've got right now. In short, make a sales pitch. But as with any sales pitch, you've got to have something to sell. You've got to have an alternative. You got to have a boat. Now, you don't like my boat? Fine. Build your own boat. Articulate your own vision, your own alternative. Give those people something positive to think about. So that's one thing that we can do. We can offer people an alternative. What else can we do? Well, consider this. In the case of both anomalies and alternatives, our focus so far has been on a particular paradigm. In other words, the focus has been on what people think. But we can also focus on how people think. What exactly is it people are doing with their minds that lead them to believe the things they do? Here our focus is not so much on a particular belief, but rather a thought process that generates beliefs. To those who think differently than you or I do, we can share with them our own way of thinking, our own thought process. Of course, sharing our thought process with others presupposes that we have a definite thought process to share. But that raises an interesting question. What exactly might that thought process be? Do those of us who call ourselves freethinkers all employ the very same thought process? Do we share that in common? I don't think we necessarily do. What I think we share in common is not so much a particular belief or thought process, but rather a dislike of religious worldviews. That being the case, it would be presumptuous of me to assume that you and I think the very same way, that we employ the very same thought process. Frankly, I don't know how you think. I can't get inside your head. I can only get inside my own head. So I only know how I think. I only know my own thought process. And I'm going to share with you that thought process, but I'll be doing that on the next show. The only point I want to make right now is that sharing with others how we think, not just what we think, but how we think, is another way to approach this project of changing minds. One of the great lessons of the scientific age has been the value of breaking up some complex thing into its simpler component parts. It's called the principle of reduction. I think we can apply this principle to this project of changing minds. I mean, if you think of this project in terms of just, let's say, you and one other person, it seems to me that we can break up this one big project into four distinct areas. First, there's what you think is wrong with the other guy's beliefs. Second, there's what you think is wrong with the other guy's thought process that leads to those beliefs. Third, there's what you think is right about your beliefs. And fourth, there's what you think is right about your thought process that leads to your beliefs. Now, in a perfect world, it would be great if we were all up to speed in all four of these areas. Unfortunately, in our encounters with religious people, all too often the focus is on just one of these four components, namely, what's wrong with the other guy's beliefs, the anomalies. The problem with this approach, I hope by now, is obvious. Not only does this approach focus on only one of these four areas, but it focuses on the one area in which we face the greatest resistance. The lesson here is that we need to take a closer look at these other three areas. Now, this might require some soul-searching on our part, and in the process, we might discover some shortcomings. For example, what exactly do you believe? Could you write a short paper stating exactly what it is you believe? And how about your thought process? Could you write a short paper describing exactly how it is you use your mind to arrive at the conclusions that you do? I mean, if we can't clearly state what we believe and why we believe it, then I think we have a real problem. I mean, if Thomas Kuhn is right about this paradigm business, then alternatives are an essential part of that process. Now, when it comes to anomalies, hey, we're loaded for bear. But when it comes to alternatives, both in terms of what we believe and how we believe, well, we may still have some work to do. Without meaningful preparation on our part in all four of these areas, our encounters with religious people are likely to generate far more heat than light. If we take this business of changing minds seriously, which is something that we must do if we ever hope to see a better future, then we need to be every bit as clear about what is right with our own ideas as we are clear about what is wrong with the other guy's ideas. I'd like to close today's show by returning to the story of my dad. It's a story with a bittersweet ending. After his negative temple experience, Dad continued to attend the Mormon church. For a while, anyway. This is not uncommon. A lot of people who reject a religious worldview nevertheless desire to remain a part of their religious community. Ironically, it's the organized part of organized religion that people often find most attractive. They like the community it provides. They like the opportunities for service. They like the ceremonies, the pretty buildings, the regular occasions to get dressed up and sing songs and talk about moral issues. So they like the organized part of organized religion. What they don't like is a religious worldview that allegedly gave rise to these activities in the first place. They don't like the superstition. They don't like the intolerance. They don't like holy books that condone slavery and genocide and the damnation of their friends. So there are parts they really like, and there are parts that they really don't like, and this can create conflict for those caught in the middle. Such was my dad's case. As I mentioned before, he continued to attend church. He even tried to change the church, if you can imagine that. It became almost an obsession with him. He came to believe that God wanted him to reform Christianity. He even talked about starting a new church. Of course, none of this talk went over well with the local church authorities. Ditto for many of his Mormon friends and even some members of the family. Then things really took a turn for the worse. In the spring of 2002, Dad was diagnosed with lung cancer. He took the news remarkably well, partly, I think, because he came to believe that his getting cancer was all part of God's plan, which was pretty much how Dad was beginning to view everything. Dad was so convinced that God was performing some great work through him that he seriously entertained the idea that God gave him this cancer on purpose just so he could miraculously heal him. Dad believed a miracle of this magnitude would draw attention to his cause. Unfortunately, this way of thinking cuts both ways. Dad began to worry that his Mormon friends were thinking that God gave him this cancer on purpose because he had rejected the Mormon church. Of course, I told Dad that this was an absurd notion and that anyone who thought such a thing could hardly be called a friend. Of course, the sad reality is that, in all likelihood, there probably were people who were thinking this. After all, look at what Pat Robertson said about Ariel Sharon's recent stroke. I sometimes wonder what Pat Robertson would have said to a guy like Job. Well, absurd or not, Dad worried about this, which only added to his troubles. Things were just not going his way. People were not buying Dad's book. He was feeling ever more alienated from friends and even some members of the family. And his cancer was just getting worse. He was growing weaker. He found it difficult to even breathe. It became painful to watch. But through it all, Dad held out hope that God would heal him, miraculously, so that he could continue doing God's work. Sadly, Dad would ultimately lose his battle with cancer, and he died on January 4th, 2003. Before Dad died, I asked him if he had any regrets about the changes he had undergone. After all, here was a man in his 70s, undergoing a paradigm shift that would turn his religious world upside down and put a strain on many of his personal relationships. Even without the cancer, this was a trying experience. And so I asked Dad if he had any regrets. Was it all worth it? His answer to me was unequivocal. He said that he wouldn't have missed this for the world. In fact, he shuddered to think that he almost lived his whole life and missed out on this great realization. To give you some sense of how he felt, I'll let Dad tell you in his own words what he thought the experience was like. This is from the book, In Defense of God, by Gerald Erickson Earle. Dad writes, and I quote, "The truths I had been taught by the Mormon Church were turning into one disappointment after another. These truths came from the standard works of the Church, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, and the Pearl of Great Price, and from books and articles written by Church officials. Mormons are then instructed to obtain our testimony through reading these study materials and through prayer. If we do, God will reveal all things to us through the power of the Holy Ghost. For the first time in my life, I elected to do otherwise. I embarked on an objective study and reading program of non-approved materials and made some startling discoveries. This has become a rewarding search and has been the most satisfying spiritual experience I have ever enjoyed. For the first time in my life, I was truly getting to know God." Unquote. So there you have it. I guess it was worth it. Change can be good. Now, I have to respectfully disagree with Dad on that part about getting to know God. I don't think he was getting to know God. I think he was getting to know himself. He was discovering his own true nature, and he liked it. Dad had effectively declared the independence of his own mind. No longer would he swallow the party line uncritically. He was free to ask questions. He was free to raise objections. He was free to think. Think for himself. What Dad had discovered was not so much a relationship with God, but the natural capacity of his own mind. So, can people change? You bet they can. Dad changed, and of course I changed. And although Dad and I disagreed on many issues, throughout this entire period of transition our relationship grew enormously. It was an odd relationship at times. Dad the radical believer, me the radical non-believer. But I learned something there too. For although Dad and I were as far apart on some of these fundamental issues as two people could possibly be, never once did we condemn each other over our disagreements. Yes, I thought he was wrong. Yes, he thought I was wrong. But we never condemned each other. There was never a sense that, oh, you don't have the right to exist because you don't believe as I do. Or, you deserve to be punished because you don't believe as I do. There was none of that. And this was refreshing. In a world where religious fanatics routinely condemn each other over things they can't possibly know anything about, Dad and I found a little oasis of civilized discourse. We had created a space where thinking was allowed.